We're ready to hear argument now in our third case of the day, Hansen against the Board of Trustees of the Hamilton Southeast School Corporation. Ms. Graziano.
May it please the Court, Mr. Wheeler. In support of the plaintiff's conclusion that the district court erred in granting summary judgment to Hamilton Southeastern School Corporation, the plaintiffs relied on the case of Delgado versus DeGaul, which is a Seventh Circuit opinion. In that decision, Delgado provides that the plaintiff, to be successful in a Title IX claim, must prove that an official of the institution who has authority to institute corrective measures has actual notice of and is deliberately indifferent to the teacher's misconduct. It is important to look further at this court's decision in that case, in that when we read it further, Delgado points out that actual knowledge of the misconduct between the teacher and the specific student is not required to attach the liability under Title IX. Specifically, the court went on to say that if there is information available to the school corporation, the institution, through and by its officials, of a known or obvious risk, that is enough to establish liability under Title IX. When you apply the facts of this case to that Delgado rationale, the district court's decision granting summary judgment in favor of HSE, Hamilton Southeastern, is an error. The facts relied upon by the plaintiffs are that Mike Nemec, who is the band director of HSE during the time that the admitted sexual battery of CH occurred, was a direct and personal friend of Mr. Alano, who was the actual teacher that admittedly sexually battered CH. During that relationship, it happened on school property. It happened in the band rooms and or the band office that were secluded rooms, soundproof rooms, and could be locked by Mr. Alano. Mr. Nemec knew that Mr. Alano had a prior relationship with a student of his from a former school employer, specifically Julie Harker, who is now Mr. Alano's wife. During the interviewing...
Wait a minute.
Yes.
He didn't know anything about the relationship while she was a student. You don't have any evidence in the record about that, do you?
We don't have any records that he knew that while she was a student they had a relationship, but he did know that the relationship began while she was a student at Waldron and Mr. Alano was, in fact, a teacher there at that time.
After the fact?
After the fact. Not after CH's complaints regarding the sexual battery occurred. It was prior to those complaints that Mr. Alano had this knowledge. Mr. Alano and Mr. Nemec have been friends since 1998.
You say that the record contains evidence that Nemec knew that the relationship between Alano and his then wife began when she was still a student of his.
What the record reflects is that Mr. Nemec knew that that relationship exists. The timing is not specifically clear in the record, Your Honor.
Well, the proposition that somebody knows that a man and his wife have sexual relations does not indicate a proclivity to rape students. Where's the basis of the inference?
The basis of the inference is that HSE, including Mr. Nemec, who is Mr. Alano's specific superior, knew that Mr. Alano had had a relationship with a prior student. Mr. Alano and Mr. Harker, or Ms. Harker.
The problem is when you keep saying a relationship, that could mean knew that she was, that his current wife used to be his student, knew that they were friends, knew that they had sexual relations. The critical question, I would think, was, is there any reason to believe that employees or officers of the defendant's school district knew that he had had sexual relations with his former student while she was his student? Is there any basis in the record for that inference?
There's not a specific evidence of actual knowledge of Mr. Nemec of the sexual relationship while she was a student of Mr. Alano. That is true.
No.
Despite the fact that there may not be that specific knowledge, the question is still is if HSE was sitting on information, that would attach liability under Title IX. Delgado specifically looks at that. And maybe they didn't know about the sexual relationship, but during Mr. Hogue's interview of both Alano and Harker, he knew at the time that Harker was a former student of Alano. At that time, they were hired during the same school season, for the same school season. They were interviewed at the same time. That information was right in front of HSE, and they failed to even ask the critical question in these cases is, was there any potential sexual relationships with any other students by Mr. Alano? Mr. Hogue never asked that question, never went that far.
His wife.
Absolutely, but his wife was not his wife when he was a student. Specifically, Mr. Alano admits in the record, in fact, on page 24 of our appendix, that there was inappropriate touching between him and Mr. Harker while she was a student, Ms. Harker, while she was a student at Waldron. So there was an inappropriate relationship prior to them being married. Secondly, Mr. Alano specifically indicates that had that question be asked, he would have offered the information that, yes, there was an inappropriate relationship between him and Ms. Harker while she was a student, and there was another relationship with him and another student, Alicia Rhodes, during the time he was the band director at the Waldron High School. This is information that HSC sat on and did nothing with it, and then hopefully, had they asked that critical question, we are in a different position, and Alano is not in this high-profile position as HSC characterizes it. Based upon that, the Title IX claim should not have been thrown out in summary judgment and should be reversed. If this court does decide that the district court properly maintained jurisdiction over the state law claims brought by CH, again, we are looking at an improper summary judgment grant based upon the status of Indiana law. The claims brought by CH were, in fact, and the Hanses were, in fact, under partially respondent superior. This is a specific and unique question under Indiana law, even at this time. In the Appellee's supplemental authority tendered to this court, they suggest that the Barnett case, Barnett versus Camille Clark, the trustee of Plaintiff Township, would in fact diminish any claims, state law claims, brought by CH and the Hansons. In this particular case, the Barnett court found that under the doctrine of respondent superior, because the defendant, the trustee, did not, the deputy trustee, did not have the ability or authority to touch or confine the plaintiff, therefore respondent superior would not attach liability to the trustee's office. The facts of this case are different here. Mr. Alano was, in fact, CH's band instructor. There were band rooms that he could use and had access to have private band lessons with the students. Ms. CH was, in fact, a clarinet player. He would have the ability to touch her in instruction of the clarinet or during the band lessons. The distinction is clear that Barnett cannot, under the doctrine of respondent superior.
That wasn't part of his job to touch her, though, was it?
Your Honor, it was not part of his job to touch her, but he had access to touch her in instructing her in her
band
lessons.
That can occur in any situation with any teacher, right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Well, you know, if you get closer to the kind of thing like in the mental hospital where they're charged with undressing or dressing somebody or bathing them, I can see you might bring it within respondeat superior. But I don't understand your argument here just because could be in a room together. What's that got to do with respondeat? That wasn't part of his job.
Well, under the Southport Little League versus Stephen Vaughn case, the Indiana Court of Appeals disagreed with that. This particular youth volunteer, in fact, was the youth volunteer for an organization.
And his responsibilities were included fitting uniforms for the players.
He did have the ability to fit the uniforms for the players.
This wasn't part of the band duties.
To fit uniforms?
Or any sort of touching.
Well, there wasn't any specific touching of the groin area or the breast area or the genitalia area of CH with regards to the band class, no. But I think the critical point here is that she was a 14, 15-year-old girl that Mr. Alano took into these private band lessons, molested her, admittedly, during those sessions, during authorized acts of the school, specifically giving her band lessons and in return giving her a passing grade for that class.
Any teacher could have a conference with a student in the teacher's office or in the classroom after the rest of the class left and so forth. That doesn't authorize a touching or an undressing.
Well, it doesn't authorize it, but the question that is required by the respondent superior argument is, in fact, that it's the question that has to be answered is specifically should be one of the jury, as the Indiana courts point out, that it should not be as a matter of law. The question is it wasn't an authorized act, and if it's an authorized act, the unauthorized act could attach liability under the respondent superior argument if it was something that transitioned from an authorized to an unauthorized act. In this particular case, taking her into the band room, giving her the private lesson, was an authorized act by Mr. Alano. When he took it further and molested her and then gave her a passing grade, those were unauthorized acts.
The Strobes versus Heritage House case, Indiana case, it was children's center workers were authorized to disrobe and bathe children. I can see how that is connected with their job, but disrobing of the CH in this case wasn't a part of the band director's job, was it?
concededly no, but the authorized act that he did do, the extension was when he went into the unauthorized act, is whether or not respondent superior, if the facts create a material issue of fact as to whether or not he was in the scope of his authorized act when the unauthorized act of molestation occurred. When that happens, that is a question for the jury to decide and not for the trial judge to decide as a matter of law. Strope specifically points that out. And so many of the other cases cited by the appellants in their case, including Strope's, Southport Little League versus Vaughn, all those cases, all those Indiana cases suggest to us that the decision as to whether or not someone was within the course and scope of their employment or if it was an authorized or unauthorized act is not a decision for the trial judge. It is a decision for the jury that is specific throughout these all of the cases, and that is an important element.
Do you have any Indiana cases that hold where school teachers are involved, unrelated, say, to where their job may be to touch them, that find liability for the school system?
Not under the doctrine of respondent superior, Your Honor.
What I'm asking about.
Not under the doctrine of respondent superior, not at this time. In addition to the respondent superior arguments, though, Your Honor, there's also arguments that have been made under theories of negligent hiring, negligent retention, and negligent supervision. Under those specific claims, Indiana courts apply a new or should have known standard. When looking at
not all of them do they? How about Levinson versus Citizens National Bank of Evansville?
Your Honor, if you could provide me the
Okay, well, let's talk about knowing or should have known. That's what you're saying? That's what they've adopted?
In the Fry versus American Painting Company, 642 Northeast 2nd, 995, the court, in fact, does specifically say that when analyzing a negligent hiring, retention, or supervision claim, the standard to be applied is whether or not the employer knew or should have known. In the case at hand, the district court at the lower level applied the new standard that the school had to know about the misconduct in order to apply to attach liability under these claims. The position of the appellants in this case and the plaintiffs is that when they used that standard, that was an improper standard, and if they had analyzed it under the new or should have known standard, the question becomes is with the information that HSC had, the fact that they had these two individuals, Alano and Harker, in their office interviewing at the same time, had they had this information, it was new or should have known that he had had prior inappropriate relationships with students. And therefore, based upon that holding, the appellants and the plaintiffs would say that the summary judgment grant on those grounds would have been an error as well. At this time, Your Honors, I have no further questions unless the panel has anything for me.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Wheeler.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tom Wheeler with the law firm of Locke Reynolds. I represent the Hamilton Southeastern School Corporation. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to jump right into a couple of questions that were asked by the bench. With respect to the question asked by Judge Caney of opposing counsel as to whether there were any school cases directly addressing this, I would direct the court to the case of Doe versus Lafayette School Corporation. It's a decision by the Indiana Court of Appeals, 846 Northeast 2nd, 691, cited at page 39 of our brief. That case really begs the colloquy that was going on here with the court and plaintiff's counsel because it discusses whether or not under Indiana law a school corporation is liable simply because a teacher uses his ability as a teacher or his access to a student to effectuate a sexual relationship with that student. Does that make the school liable? In the Doe case, the Indiana Court of Appeals said no. In Doe, the teacher used an email account. He became introduced to the student through the school, used his school-sponsored email account to forward his relationship with the student. He then consummated a sexual relationship with the school, with the student, away from school. The student's parents sued the school corporation, alleging respondeat superior, simply because you had access to the student. This is therefore an authorized act, and you went beyond that authorized act to have sex with the student. Jury question goes to the jury. Indiana Court of Appeals said no. They said simply because the teacher has access to the student because of their job as a teacher is not enough to get you past summary judgment on respondeat superior. And that is consistent with the Indiana Court of Appeals case in Conkle versus Henson. In the Conkle case, it involved a priest. A priest had access to a parishioner and eventually engaged sex in her, and the court said, no, that's not enough. With respect to respondeat superior and utilizing the Strope's case, the Indiana courts have consistently said, divided these cases into two. You have Strope's and you have Southport Little League on one side of the fence. In those two cases, the individuals are specifically authorized to touch the nude or disrobed body of the particular person. In Stropes, it was a nurse's aide and a disabled patient. In Southport Little League, as Judge Tinder pointed out, it was a Little League baseball player who was being fitted not only with the uniform but with a protective cup, and therefore he was authorized to touch the naked or disrobed body of those two. On those side of cases, the courts have said, the Indiana Supreme Court and the Indiana Court of Appeals has said, yes, that goes to the jury. On the other side of that line are cases like Conkle and Doe, where there is no such authorization to touch the disrobed body of the victim. That's why the Barnett case is so important. In Barnett versus Clark, and I will admit that I argued that case, and in fact part of this brief is part of the one of the briefs that was presented to the Indiana Supreme Court withdrew from Stropes. What the Indiana Court of Appeals said is they said whether or not an act is authorized, whether the employee has gone beyond the authorized act into the unauthorized act of the sexual misconduct, the Indiana Court of Appeals held that that is always a jury question. That was the Indiana Supreme Court took that issue on certiorari. And basically the holding in Barnett, and we filed this case with the court as supplemental authority, the holding in Barnett says, wait, Stropes does not go that far. The Indiana Supreme Court said one of the first questions was, should we overrule Stropes entirely? They chose not to overrule Stropes entirely, but they chose to limit Stropes, not only in the non-delegable duty area, but on the idea of how far do these authorized acts go. That's why the discussion that was cited in our brief in Barnett versus Clark, where the Supreme Court goes through what the authorized acts, and they say he was not authorized to touch her, he was not authorized to hold her hand, to comfort her, similar things. That takes it out of even the summary judgment, out of a jury question, and makes it a summary judgment question, a question of law for the court. That's precisely what the court did in this case. The district court judge had before him specific evidence, in fact, specific testimony from both Mr. Alano and indeed the plaintiff herself. I asked the plaintiff during her deposition, would this have been part of his authorized acts to disrobe you, to touch you, to comfort you, any of the actions that were in the Stropes case? And she said no. And she said during her deposition, Ms. Hansen, while represented by counsel, that this was not an authorized act. These sexual encounters were not authorized. Mr. Alano also testified that he was specifically advised that any inappropriate contact with students was forbidden. It was against school policy. He acknowledged that it was a violation of the teacher handbook. It was a violation of the rules, and he admitted.
I hope there are no school districts in Indiana that have a policy favoring statutory rape.
I agree, Your Honor. And he admitted that any such contact, touching her disrobed body, any of the contact that was alleged to be, would have been, and this is the teacher himself, outside the course and scope of his employment. So the evidence before the court that Judge McKinney had in making his decision on the respondeat superior claim clearly falls directly within Barnett versus Clark, and such that the teacher is not authorized to go beyond that. The Stropes line of cases falls directly within the Doe, Conkle, and the Barnett cases because those authorized acts did not include either disrobing, or otherwise touching a nude or unclothed body of the student in this particular case. If I may, I want to jump over to the Title IX argument just briefly. And frankly, I'm a little perplexed by the continued reliance on the Delgado case. I think that everybody here, the counsel on both sides, agrees that the standard that the Supreme Court has set forth in the Davis case, which is a peer sexual harassment case, the Davis versus Monroe case under Title IX, is you have to show, one, actual knowledge, and number two, deliberate indifference. And, of course, the reason for that is that Title IX is a spending statute claim. And, therefore, in order to invoke Title IX and spending statute, the court has held that there needs to be some type of showing of intentional conduct in this context. And the court in the Davis case specifically rejected the application of a negligence standard, a new or should have known standard that the plaintiff here suggests this court adopts. The court said that we declined the invitation to impose liability under what amounted to a negligence standard, holding the district liable for its failure to react to teacher-student harassment of which it knew or should have known. Rather, we concluded that the district could be liable for damages only where the district itself intentionally acted in violation of Title IX by remaining deliberately indifferent to acts of teacher-student harassment of which it had actual knowledge. That's the Supreme Court in the Davis case citing the Gerbster case. So that's the controlling precedent. Delgado took that a little bit differently. The defense in Delgado argued that the notice that is required, the actual notice that is required, is actual notice of the specific conduct of which the plaintiff complains. They said, look, in Delgado, they argued the school didn't know that the teacher was harassing this particular individual, and therefore we go out on summary judgment under Title IX. Judge Posner, writing for the court in the Delgado case, said, wait a sec, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And they just recognized the common sense proposition that if a school knows that a teacher is harassing a group of students or has a pattern of harassing students, that is sufficient to meet the actual notice requirement. We will then step on to the next part of it, the deliberate indifference. The key part of this case and why I failed to understand the plaintiff's continued reliance on Delgado is we have absolutely no evidence of a pattern and practice harassment. It isn't as if someone had come forward, for example, and said, Mr. Alano has a pattern and practice. He has harassed three girls. And it's not uncommon in a school corporation, for example, if you have a teacher that is, quote, too close to the students or a teacher that is too touchy-feely, where administrators come in and warn those individuals and say, look, on their evaluation, it will say, you are too close to the students. You have engaged in, it's not necessarily inappropriate conduct, but in this day and age, for example, a simple hug can be misinterpreted within the school context. And, in fact, interesting enough, it's been very misinterpreted here. The plaintiff's counsel spent a portion of their time discussing the, quote, relationship between Mr. Alano and Ms. Harker. The, quote, inappropriate portion of the relationship that took place while they were student, while she was a student and he was a teacher, the testimony was that he gave her one hug in the band room. That's the only inappropriate relationship. Ms. Harker testified upon deposition that absolutely nothing happened while she was a student. In fact, nothing happened until she was a college student, and they no longer had the teacher-student relationship, as did Mr. Alano. So the characterization of an inappropriate relationship that the school could have discovered, I think, is fairly misleading. The only evidence in the record was that there was a single hug between the two in the band room. Now, within that framework, within the Title IX framework, the school corporation believes that I promoted Judge McKinney. Judge McKinney.
You promoted him over me.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. Judge McKinney got it right with respect to this. He applied what the Supreme Court has clearly said, and this court has clearly said, which is there actual notice? The plaintiffs themselves have conceded in their briefs that there was no actual notice. They are trying to rely on should have known under Title IX, and this court and the Supreme Court have clearly rejected a should have known or a negligence standard. There is one issue, and I don't know if it has now been waived. There was a jurisdictional issue presented both in the original argument and in the reply brief relating to whether or not Judge McKinney should have gone on after he resolved the Title IX and Section 1983 issues in favor of the school, whether he should have gone on and addressed the supplemental state law claims. I'm not sure if the plaintiffs are intending to present it. It doesn't make a lot of sense because, of course, as the court is presumably aware, Judge McKinney retained jurisdiction. Mr. Alano remains a defendant in the lower court, and he remains a defendant both with respect to federal claims. There's a Section 1983 claim currently pending with Mr. Alano, with Judge McKinney, and there is also a series of supplemental state law claims. So the plaintiff's contention that, quote, as they said in their reply brief, quote, all federal claims have been resolved is simply inaccurate. Judge McKinney, in his order on Mr. Alano's partial summary judgment, said count three through seven remain pending. Count three is a Section 1983 claim. The final issue I'll address fairly briefly, which is with respect to the negligent hiring, negligent retention, negligent supervision claim. The case law is clear that it is a known standard. Did you know, for example, at the time that you were supervising him? And it makes common sense. Look, negligent supervision means somebody comes to you and says, hey, there's something wrong, and then you fail to do something about it. That's the point of a negligent supervision. You have failed to properly supervise that individual. And Indiana case law makes it very clear, and we go through that in our brief, and I'm not going to redo what's in the brief. The negligent hiring standard, again, there are two aspects to that. Number one, did you do something wrong in the hiring process? Superintendent Hogue went through in great detail, and I'm not going to go through a lot of what was done, but he did, in fact, in the initial application, each of the teachers are required to sign an affirmation that they have not engaged in misconduct, and particularly sexual misconduct. So the supposition that had he asked these questions, it had already been asked on the initial application. But more importantly, the school corporation went through a very detailed process. The evidence in the record is that the principal of Waldron High School gave Mr. Alano a glowing recommendation. He recommended him for outstanding moral character, a person of high individual. He was in the top, I believe, 5% of people that he had recommended. That recommendation was given to the school 2 months before he was hired by the school. So the school, in this case, did everything they could So, number one, negligent hiring. The plaintiffs have to show, one, you didn't do something, and number two, had you done something, you'd have found something that would have caused you not to hire this individual. And they fail in both parts. Number one, the school did everything it was supposed to do, and there was nothing that they have pointed to that the school had the school missed something. For example, they'd failed to call a reference. That reference would have told you that, yes, he is engaged in misconduct. In this case, they failed to come forward with either side of that evidence, and as a consequence, Judge McKinney didn't err in granting summary judgment on the negligent hiring claim as well. If the court has nothing further, I'll yield back the remainder of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. Anything further, Ms. Graziano?
With regards to the jurisdictional question, the plaintiffs are not waiving that issue. The question is whether...
One can never waive a jurisdictional question, but I don't understand how the argument is consistent with 1367, which says that federal courts can, completely independent of the pending claim still in the district court, 1367 says that federal courts can either exercise or relinquish supplemental jurisdiction after deciding the federal question. So how could there be a defect of subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, based upon the cases cited by the appellants in their opening brief, the Seventh Circuit's practice is that once the federal claims, in fact, are dismissed.
The question of sound practice is not a question of subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct.
It's a question about how appropriately should the discretion granted by 1367 be used. But why would one characterize that as a question of jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, in the brief, we questioned it under whether or not they retain jurisdiction over the supplemental state law claims. It would probably be inaccurate for a heading purposes, but in the argument portion itself, the question is whether or not they should have retained that jurisdiction over the state law claims and rendered their decision when the issue before the district court is a very unique, fact-specific issue that is going on in this state at this time. There are cases, as Mr. Wheeler points out, on both ends of the coin. If you look at some of the cases, you have the court saying that it's a jury question as to whether or not it's an authorized versus an unauthorized act. You have some case saying that's a matter of law. So you have a very unique circumstance here at Indiana state law cases that are all over the board, so the Indiana state law court should be the one to decide that decision. And I think that that's basically why the preference is to send it back down in state court when you have such a unique and unsettled area of the law.
Was this case removed from state court?
No, it was not, Your Honor. It was specifically brought on a Title IX claim with the supplemental state jurisdiction.
So you were seeking federal resolution of the issue you're talking about then, right?
Initially, the plaintiffs were. They were not represented by our office at the time, but initially when they filed the complaint, they were. However, when the Title IX decision was rendered, as the Title IX did not provide liability for the appellants against HSE, at that point in time, because of the uniqueness of the state law claims, it is the position of the plaintiffs and the appellants that the court should have sent this back down to state law claim and remanded it for further proceedings. Secondly, with regards to the Doe versus Lafayette case.
I see, counsel, how it could be remanded. It was not removed from state court. Only a case that's removed can be remanded. And I don't see how it could be dismissed because the claim against the teacher was still pending in the state court. Usually, if you file a claim in federal court under 1367, you resolve the federal issues and then dismiss the state issues without prejudice.
Correct.
It's not clear how that could be done as long as the claim is still pending on the merits against the teacher.
But there are no claims pending on the merits against the school corporation, and that is those claims that specifically need to be addressed.
But, no, look, if you're making an argument about respondeat superior, wouldn't it be positively weird to have the claim against the employer sent to state court while the claim against the employee is still pending in federal court?
Not in my interpretation, no, Your Honor. It would not be. Either he's within or without the scope of his employment under the case law and as well as the federal courts, and based upon that, it should have been resolved by the Indiana state courts rather than by Judge McKinney in the district court. And for those reasons, we would submit that the summary judgment grant should be reversed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Counsel?
I realize this is unusual. May I approach for just a moment?
No, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a brief recess. After the recess, the judges will return, and we'll be happy to have a discussion with those of you who are interested in the way in which the Seventh Circuit operates. And the general nature of what happened here today, we obviously can't discuss these cases, but we'll be happy to have a general discussion with you about appellate practice and the Seventh Circuit. But for now, the court is in recess.